College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Negandhi.
I am not Kevin Negandhi. I am Ivan Maisel sitting in for Kevin today, and I am joined by my longtime friend and colleague, Ryan McGee, as we do what has come to be I'd say enjoyable, which sounds odd given the subject, but an enjoyable custom at the end of the year. We remember the college football personages who have died over the previous 12 months. And Ryan, I know you feel the way I do, that these are people that have populated our lives, and we feel like it's if not a duty, at least a responsibility to remember them for what they gave to the sport.
Yeah, duty is the right word, because I take this seriously, and I think you do too, because as with a lot of things during the CFB 150 season, it's an opportunity to educate people on names that they might not know, or maybe something they will learn about a name that they did know.
That's right, and the other thing is that there are a lot of people we left out because we don't want this podcast to go on for hours, and it's unfortunate, but we're going to try to get to as many people as we can in this period of time. And to start with, it was an unusual year and I suppose sad year in the fact that we lost three Heisman Trophy winners in 2019. Joe Bellino, of Navy, running back who won it in 1960, and was remembered primarily because he was a great player at Navy. He did play a little professional football, was not a resounding success in pro ball, but boy, did he have certainly a great 1960 season. He rushed for 824 yards, 14 touchdowns. He caught four touchdown passes. He was a punter, actually a quick kicker. He returned kicks and was remembered especially for how well he played against Army. He scored five touchdowns in 3 years against Army, and Ryan, in the 1960 game, late in the game, he fumbled at the Navy 17, setting up Army to steal the game, and then turned around, and in those days where some guys played both ways, made an interception at the goal line to preserve the game. So Joe Bellino was a certainly a Navy hero.
I remember when I was a student at Tennessee and worked on the film crew, and we were ingesting all this old classic film and transferring it to video. We're one of the few schools that could do that. And I remember Johnny Majors came in one day and he's like, "What's the greatest catch you guys have ever seen?" And we're like, "Oh, I don't know, coach, so-and-so," and everything we came up with was in the last 5 years. And Coach Majors was like, "Your homework assignment is to find the last catch at the end of the 1961 Orange Bowl, Navy and Missouri." I got up and left. And so now we're trying to find old film, and we're calling Orange Bowl, and we're calling Missouri. And it was a catch by Bellino in the end zone. It was the last score in the game. And it was one of those ridiculous catches I've ever seen. And that's how I even learned who he was in the first place. Listen, all you have to do at the end of the day, if you play at Navy or at Army, is they ask you, how did you perform in the Army-Navy game? And he's pretty good.
He was pretty good and was a quiet man. He did not wear his Heisman trophy as, "Hey, look at me." He lived quietly in New England, died shortly after he turned 81 in March. And was the one of, as I said, one of three Heisman Trophy winners, the first of the three to die this year. The second was, I believe, the oldest living Heisman winner. Howard Cassidy was his given name, although nobody called him that. He was obviously known as Hopalong Cassidy. Obvious if you grew up in that day when there was a star of both movies and radio. Was an actor who played a character named Hopalong Cassidy. And Hopalong Cassidy, the running back for Ohio State, grew up in the Columbus area, was not particularly big, but he was a terrific athlete, averaged over five and a half yards a carry for Woody Hayes. And I don't know if I buy this. Woody Hayes once said that Cassidy was an enormously effective runner because he ran in a straight line, which meant he got from point A to point B very quickly. You know, in Woody's mind, it was a sin to veer toward the sideline. But he said Cassidy shot through the line so fast that nobody could get a crack at him. He was the bell cow for the Buckeye National Champions his junior year, the year that solidified Woody's grasp on that job, 1954. And get this, he was not only a terrific running back, but he also played outfield for the Buckeyes. And in 1954, they won the national championship in football. And then in the spring of 55, he hit 327 and played outfield for the Buckeyes that won the Big Ten baseball title. He's pretty good.
Yeah. Not bad at all. And Ohio State was a bit of a baseball power back in those days. And I don't know if the story is true or not, but, I was up at Ohio State actually the week that he passed away. And the story that I was told was that there was one day in practice and, Cassidy was, they were trying to run this one particular, you know, play, just, you know, typical Ohio State in the middle of the field running play. And it just kind of wasn't going anywhere. And so Woody Hayes plugs in the backup running back who, you know, runs the play perfectly, takes off down the field. And Woody Hayes says to Cassidy, "Did you see that? He's slow enough to make the play work. You're going too fast." I don't know if it was true or not, but that's the story I was told in the football building, the very week he passed away.
That's terrific. Cassidy befriended somehow, and it had to do with Ohio State because George Steinbrenner was a football coach in the Big Ten during the 50s and, of course, was from Columbus. And they became friends, and Steinbrenner hired Cassidy as a speed coach, and he worked in the Yankees farm system for years and was known famously or infamously as one of the few guys, if not the only guy, that Steinbrenner never fired. So, but he wore his Heisman celebrity quite well. He was renowned around Ohio State. Howard Hopalong Cassidy, the third Heisman winner to die in 2019, just this month, Pat Sullivan, the Auburn quarterback. In 1971, he was won the Heisman in 1971. He was a 3-year starter at quarterback. Came from Birmingham and was an electrifying presence for Auburn football. In his first varsity game, the first game of his sophomore year, 1969, Auburn scored on 6 of its first 7 possessions and beat Wake Forest 57-0, and that was the beginning of an incredible era in Auburn football. I think the first Iron Bowl I ever went to was in 1969, and Auburn just absolutely spanked Alabama 49-26 on the strength of Pat Sullivan throwing to Terry Beasley, who was his favorite target, and they worked together for 3 years. I will tell you that when he won the Heisman in 1971, it was a very close vote between him and Ed Marinaro, the running back at Cornell and the last real Ivy League candidate for the Heisman. Marinaro finished first in 3 of the geographic regions in which they tally votes for the Heisman, but Sullivan had 60 more first place votes and won a narrow victory. The announcement was made Thanksgiving in those days. It was 2 days before Auburn played Alabama in one of the great games, certainly in the history of the Iron Bowl. Both teams were undefeated. That was Alabama's first year in the wishbone and an incredible comeback by Bear Bryant and the Tide from a couple of years of mediocrity. And they, there was always some thought that perhaps there was some Heisman hangover. 2 days later, Alabama spanked Auburn 31-7, but it did not, certainly didn't diminish who Pat Sullivan was and what he meant to Auburn University.
Well, and where I got to know him a little was as the head coach of the Samford Bulldogs.
Yes.
And took a program that, quite frankly, there in Birmingham hadn't done much of anything over the years. And I think his last, I think he had winning seasons in his last three or four seasons and went to the playoffs, the back then we called 1AA playoffs, FCS. And, that's where I got to know him a little bit. And it was, he was just fun. And I was always struck by the
nice
fact
man.
That, and I was struck by the fact that he came along and was slinging it, you know, with Auburn and Shook Jordan when everyone else obviously was just playing between the tackles. And I always think about the great showdown. That 1971 year started with this great showdown with Archie Manning in the Gator Bowl and then ended, you know, the following season with the Heisman Trophy. So a good man, and we're fortunate to get to know him a little bit.
He was one of the nicest people I've met in college football. Vince Dooley, Auburn defeated an undefeated Georgia team in 1971, late in 1971, Sullivan's senior year, and Dooley called Sullivan the best quarterback he had ever seen. He threw for 248 yards and four touchdowns, and Auburn beat Georgia 35-20. In addition to being the head coach at Samford, he was also the head coach at TCU, and LSU actually made him an offer to be head coach, but TCU wouldn't let him out of the contract. And Sullivan did not have the money for the buyout clause, so he stayed at TCU and eventually lost that job, went to Samford, and was always a presence and a figure of some renown in the state of Alabama. Pat Sullivan died this year after this month after a long battle with cancer. Speaking of players better known as players than coaches, Willie Brown, who was a Pro Football Hall of Famer and a star at Grambling in the 60s for Eddie Robinson. I include him, well, for one thing, he was a terrific player and a real gentleman, but his one season as a head coach in college football was in 1991. He was a head coach at Long Beach State. And he replaced the famous George Allen, who had been a longtime NFL head coach. And at the end of the season, in which Long Beach State went 2-9, the university disbanded the program. So Willie Brown, the last head coach at Long Beach State University, but one of the many great players that Eddie Robinson sent out from Grambling,
and maybe the greatest shot in NFL films history.
Yes.
Is the right, the super slow-mo, him staring directly at the camera and in that Raiders uniform. I mean, honestly, as a you subscribe to Sports Illustrated, they send you the VHS tape, right, of the NFL moments. And every documentary that NFL Films has ever done has had that long slow-motion shot of Willie Brown and the intensity in his eyes coming through that face mask. That was my introduction to him. And obviously, you have conversations with people about HBCU football, and he's one of the pillars and obviously with, you know, maybe arguably one of the greatest coaches of all time. But Willie Brown, I mean, just a pillar of HBCU football, and then obviously of those great Raiders teams.
He was not drafted by the AFL or NFL, and Eddie Robinson once said, you know, after Brown retired, that one of the issues was that he played split end and linebacker at Grambling, but he was so talented and such a Swiss Army knife that Eddie didn't say that. I'm trying to explain what he could do, but he said he could have played running back or tight end because he was such a good blocker, in addition to the fact that he actually did play split end and linebacker. So Willie Brown, the Grambling star. One guy who died this month, just recently, Bump Elliott, Bump Elliott was one of two brothers that played at Michigan and then enjoyed long careers as coaches in the Midwest. Bump Elliott was the Big Ten MVP and an All-American for the great Michigan team in 1947, his senior year. That was Fritz Kreisler's last team at Michigan. And Elliott immediately went into coaching after his senior year. And for the next 44 years, he spent all but three of them either at Michigan or at Iowa. He was the head coach at Michigan for 10 seasons. From 1959 through 1968, Bo Schembechler's predecessor. And he won 51 games, lost 42, tied two in those 10 seasons, won the 1964 Big Ten title, but is best known for his 21 years, as the athletic director at Iowa, where he hired Dan Gable to coach wrestling.
Maybe the greatest coach Davis. In the history of coaches. Dan Gable.
Yeah. He hired Tom Davis to coach basketball, and most important to probably our listeners, he hired Hayden Fry at Iowa to coach football. So he had an eye for talent.
Yeah. I think he hired Vivian Stringer.
Ah.
Yeah, Lute Olson.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's
and Lute Olson. Yeah. Very good point. Yeah. Sorry. I only got three of the best five.
Right. Yeah. No, the list is amazing. And he actually played at Purdue, right? And then, went and served.
He did play at Purdue.
In the war and, in World War II and then came back and joined his brother at Michigan. And, I mean, what an amazing, that is a lifetime spent in collegiate athletics. I mean, what a story.
The last game I covered at Iowa, which was 3 or 4 years ago, he was at the game in the press box, and I went up and introduced myself. And everything they said about Bump Elliott was that he was a gentleman and extremely nice man, and he was when I introduced myself and met him, but I had a couple of questions about when he had been head coach at Michigan, and he just didn't remember. And but was really nice and revered on that campus. And I know that there's a real sense of loss at both Michigan and Iowa with the passing of Bump Elliott. Another athletic director of some fame, Sam Jankovich. Sam Jankovich was the athletic director after having been an assistant coach, was the athletic director at Washington State from 1976 to 1983, and then left to go to Miami, and was the athletic director for the Canes from 1983 to 1990. In his tenures at those two schools, he hired Jim Walden, who was a terrific coach at Washington State for years, but more important, at Miami, he hired both Jimmy Johnson and Dennis Erickson. So he hired two coaches who, in the span of five seasons, won three national championships for the Canes.
Not bad. And I talked to him on the phone. As you know, I wrote a worst-selling book about the College World Series years ago. And I talked to him on the phone multiple times when I was working on the book about building this dynasty of baseball at the University of Miami, and him talking to me about facilities. And of course, and he was worked in the NFL as well with the Patriots, but him talking to me about the facilities, about the baseball field smelled like spoiled milk and the Orange Bowl smelled like spoiled beer. And he said, and you just got a power washer and made it work. And it was, I love talking to those guys about making, but that transition in the 80s, from when everything still kind of felt like it did in the 50s, 60s, and 70s to what it became in the 90s and the 2000s, and he was one that was so instrumental in that.
Well, Miami was such a power in the 80s, or became such a power in the late 80s, early 90s, and it really was, for lack of a better term, a mom-and-pop operation. And but Jankovich was an extremely smart guy and very shrewd about people. And he knew Erickson from Washington State. He had been there, and from his connections in the Northwest. His first coach at Washington State was Jackie Sherrill, but Jackie was only there a year, and he, you know, not everybody he hired was a home run. He also hired Warren Powers at Washington State, who also only stayed a year. But then between Walden, Johnson, and Erickson, Sam Jankovic did pretty well. Left in 1990, as you said, he left Miami to be the general manager of the Patriots. In the pre-Bob Kraft era, that did not last very long. But Sam Jankovic, one of the many pillars of college football, who died in 2019. We will be back some more with some more memorials right after this word from Allstate.
Because mayhem on Saturdays in the fall is inevitable. Mayhem happens on the field, off the field, and in the polls. Mayhem lives on the wind, in the rain, on the foot of an errant kick, and during a trap game. You'll find mayhem in the parking lot, during tailgates, charcoal that's not totally out, an errant football through a window, a flat tire, a lost side view mirror, etc. You get the point. Allstate protects you from mayhem in the parking lot and outside it, at home and away. You can't stop mayhem from happening, but you can get better protected from it with Allstate. The potential for mayhem during the playoff race is rampant. Underdogs, trap games, unexpected weather, etc., etc., etc. Get better protected from mayhem with Allstate. Contact your local Allstate agent today.
So, Ryan, let's dip into the world of media and a guy near and dear to both our hearts who died in 2019, Dan Jenkins, the longtime sports writer, who's, I will say, second love, because I know he loved his family first, but his second love was college football, I think, ahead of golf. He covered those two for years, both at papers in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and most famously for Sports Illustrated. He was an iconic figure to sports writers of our generation, and just a terrific man, the father of Sally Jenkins of the Washington Post, an old friend of mine, and no one loved college football more than Dan Jenkins and his beloved TCU Horned Frogs.
And at your suggestion, I was going to TCU for the first time several years ago. They were in the middle of a run at a Big 12 title, and at your suggestion, I found him. Because I had told you how much I loved him and didn't know him and never met him. And you're like, well, he's right there. And he showed up that day and I kind of cornered him, during the media lunch. And I'm so glad that I did because it was everything that I hoped that it would be. And for a kid like me, who was the one that went to the school library to go find the magazines and the newspapers, just to read the sports columns. And who subscribed to Sports Illustrated and read all these names to finally have a chance to sit down and realize that he talked exactly like he wrote, but his writing was so distinctive. And I mean, a captain of the, you know, try to write a sentence no one has ever read before mantra. And that's exactly what it was like.
Boy,
sitting there
talking
to him. Yeah. And it was the smartest stand-up comedy I'd ever heard, having lunch with him at the at the football stadium in Fort Worth.
It was always a treat. Among the many honors he received throughout his career, and really toward the end of his career, because he kept writing and he was tweeting up until a few weeks before he died.
Amazing.
But he was the National Football Foundation. Honored him 10 years ago, the Contributions to American Football Award. And TCU named the press box at Amon Carter Stadium. It's the Dan Jenkins press box. And late this season, I covered a TCU game, and Mark Cohen, who's been the SID there forever, and just absolutely loved Dan, and Dan loved him, was telling me that after they named the press box for him, the family all came to a game, and Dan asked Mark, he said, well, is it okay? I need this many seats in the press box. And Dan said, I mean, Mark said, Dan, it's your press box. You can have whatever you want. But he had a parking spot right next to the chancellor in the bowels of Amon Carter Stadium. That was the regard in which TCU held him. Gary Patterson loved him, you know, the longtime head coach of TCU. And you know, rather than me try to pick out, I think both of us, if we tried to pick out our favorite Dan Jenkins lines, this podcast could go on forever. But I would just suggest to everyone that pick up his book, Saturday's America, which is a great distillation of what college football was in the 60s and early 70s. Or if you can go, if you have a subscription to Sports Illustrated, go to si.com/vault and read his stories, because his story of the 1971 Nebraska-Oklahoma game remains one of the best college football stories ever written. He presaged the coming great recruiting wars of the last generation with a story about Jack Mildren, who became the All-America quarterback of that Oklahoma team in the late 60s, early 70s. And Dan just parked at the Mildren house in Abilene and talked about everybody who came through. So Dan Jenkins, which was certainly a real blow to those of us who grew up reading him, the loss of Dan Jenkins. Really a sad and tragic loss in college football. Rod Bramlett, the voice of the Auburn Tigers, died in an automobile crash this year. And best known, of course, for his calls of the kick six and the Georgia Hail Mary Georgia victory 2 weeks before the kick six in that magical 2013 season. But Bramlett had been at Auburn forever and was just so identified with that university. Such a nice guy. Just a tragic loss of Rod Bramlett this year.
Well, and a dear friend. And you know, it's a reminder. I was at Auburn twice this past fall, and it's the first football season without him. And we went and sat in his radio booth where he had the call of the kick six, one of the greatest calls of one of the greatest plays in the history of college football. And the conversation that I had with his family and friends was about the fact that, you know, for eternity, as long as they're playing college football, we're going to hear Rob Bramlett's voice because of that play and because of other plays, but that one in particular. And it just what Rod's story reminds me is, it should remind all of us, is that tomorrow is not guaranteed. Because he and his wife were just driving down the road and it was over. And so, a good friend and a good man, and his voice is going to echo in that stadium as long as it's standing there.
The longtime voice of the Kansas Jayhawks, Max Falkenstein, died this year. Max, I don't think he covered the Jayhawks when James Naismith invented basketball, but he'd been there about that long. Max was a great example of the way that announcers, play-by-play guys, become beloved by fan bases. He was at Kansas forever. And you couldn't think really of Kansas athletics without thinking of Max.
Yeah, and I've said this to you before, and you and I both do this. Our favorite thing to do on a Friday night when we're in town to cover a game is to scroll through the AM radio and listen to high school sports. And I love the fact that when you go to Kansas, it doesn't matter. I think his last game was in 2006, but you ride around and listen to high school basketball or football on AM radio anywhere in the state of Kansas, and everyone sounds exactly like Max Falkenstein because he's the guy. I mean, he's the voice of generations. And so it's, I love the fact that, I mean, it was 60 years he was a sportscaster. So I love the fact that, everyone's voice down there, they sound exactly like him.
The other media personage I wanted to mention, Don Bernstein, who was the was the media contact for ABC Sports in the heyday of ABC Sports as the network of college football. Don started out on the West Coast as a SID at UC Santa Barbara as well as at Washington, and then he came to New York for the network. He was just a wonderful man with a loud, bombastic voice, but so friendly, so helpful. When the BCS came into being in the 90s and they needed a seasoned guy who knew the media and knew the sport, they hired Don Bernstein to help be the voice of the BCS, and it did provide some credibility for those of us who were trying to figure out whether this was a legitimate thing or just some cockamamie excuse to screw up the bowl system. But it was a delight. Don was just a friendly guy, knew everybody in the sport, and really a fixture, and he will be missed.
Knew everybody, period. Would sit there. Yes. Rosa Gatti, who worked at ESPN and PR forever, introduced me to him, and in the course of a conversation, would talk about something Vince Lombardi told him, or working with Bob Iger, you know, now all of our bosses at Disney, and would just talk about it just matter of fact. And he was so disarming about it that you'd walk away later and go, did he just tell me a story about hanging out with Vince Lombardi the week of Super Bowl I? Because I think he did, and I kind of missed it because for him, it was just life.
Yes. Yeah. No, he was just a wonderful man, and I'm so sorry he's gone. Let's get back to the field. A guy that was better known as a player than he was as a coach, but really an important figure in the history of the last generation of college football, Forrest Gregg, who was an offensive lineman on Lombardi's great Packer teams of the 60s, is in the Pro Football Hall of Fame for that play, played at SMU, and when SMU came back from the death penalty in the late 80s and early 90s and needed somebody whose character was beyond reproach and who knew football and could instill a physical, tough brand of play to get SMU, try to get SMU back up to speed from scratch, they went to Forrest Gregg. And he did a nice job. It took a long time for SMU to win, and he didn't win a lot there, but he gave his alma mater instant credibility, and I'll just always remember there was almost a rectitude about him in the way he handled himself, and there was a right way and a wrong way to do things, and Forrest Gregg was always on the right side of that line.
And I always think about, in my opinion, maybe the greatest 30 for 30 that was ever produced, and that was the Pony Excess that they did about SMU, and I always think about there's this one unbelievable shot of Forrest Gregg that sums up exactly what you're talking about, which is it's all this chaos and this and that happened and, you know, free Mazdas and cash and all this stuff. And then when it was time to come back and do it the right way, and all they did was they cut to a shot of Forrest Gregg sitting there with his Super Bowl ring on. And all you saw was a man that was like, this man is not going to put up with anything from anyone. I always think about, I don't know if it was the first or second year that SMU was back and they played Houston, and this was at the height of the run and shoot.
The first year, yeah.
Yeah, the first year.
1989.
Right. And Andre Ware had a half a dozen touchdown passes, and Klingler had, I think, almost that in the second half. David Klingler did, and Forrest Gregg would not shake Jake Pardee's hand because he just said that's not how you do this. And he just had that look on his face. He's the most Texas-looking face that there's ever been, and that's a man that put up with nothing from anyone.
It was a Mount Rushmore face. The score of that game was Houston 95, SMU 21. That was SMU's first year back after the death penalty.
I remember it was close to 100. I forgot it was 95.
Yeah, and Greg was only the coach two seasons. They won three games in those two seasons, but he provided the ballast that that program needed. And speaking of a rectitude, a different form, because he was a charming man and a guy I know that you knew for many, many years, James Robertson, who was not only an official in the ACC, but the longtime faculty athletic representative at Virginia Tech.
Yeah, we called him Bud. And just last week at the SEC championship game, we had the opportunity to have Vince Dooley on Marty and McGee. And the first thing that Coach Dooley said to me was, he said, "I am so sad about the death of Bud Robertson." And Bud Robertson was the referee, was the white hat in Vince Dooley's last game, the Gator Bowl in, I guess it was 89, 90. And Bud Robertson was, all due respect to Shelby Foote, Bud Robertson was the expert on the Civil War and would travel the world, and people would travel the world to get to him, just for the knowledge off the top of his head about that. I mean, a Pulitzer nominee. I mean, this is a man that, and then went out and officiated football games on Saturday afternoons. He was on my father's, I talk about it all the time, was an ACC official forever, and Bud Robertson and Dad were on the same crew, for a while. And Bud Robertson, Dr. Robertson, was always the one that you pointed to say, "Everybody in section 231, you can scream and yell about how stupid the referees are at this point, but the reality is the smartest man on the field, the smartest man in the stadium is the guy with the white hat on right now. So yell all you want, but he has about 19 college degrees and spent last week, you know, at Gettysburg giving lectures."
That's wonderful. Yeah, I knew him a little bit just from my years of covering NCAA conventions, and he was unfailingly polite and courteous and interesting. I always had a good take on whatever was the feverish issue of that day in terms of athletic governance. So Bud Robertson, a longtime fixture at Virginia Tech and in ACC football. We've got a few more people to remember in the world of college football who died in 2019, and we will get to them right after this word from Dr. Pepper.
Make sure to tune in to my new favorite TV show, Fansville, presented by Dr. Pepper, returning every Saturday throughout the college football season during the commercials. Fansville is the only show that stars Dr. Pepper, puts the spotlight on fans, and perfectly captures the emotional roller coaster that is the college football season. Critics are saying it's good, fantastic, is anyone else thirsty, and literally the best thing since Diet Dr. Pepper and Dr. Pepper Cherry. In Fansville, Dr. Pepper delivers a tour de force performance alongside legendary college football co-stars Brian the Boz Bosworth and Eddie George. Experience the pain, the passion, and the deliciousness of college football fandom this fall on Fansville, presented by Dr. Pepper. So pull over, veer right, slant left, do what you gotta do to get to your local store and pick up some refreshing ice-cold Dr. Pepper, the official drink of Fansville. And hey, while you're at it, don't be afraid to go for two.
Ivan Maisel back here with Ryan McGee as we remember the people we lost in college football in the world of 2019. This one a little bit personal to me. I did not know John Ralston, who was the head coach at Utah State, Stanford, and San Jose State. But having gone to Stanford, I certainly heard my share of stories about John Ralston. He was at Stanford for nine seasons from 1963 to 71. And in his career there is a fascinating look at what college football used to be. His first five seasons at Stanford, the Indians, as they were known back then, went 24-25-1. And, you know, find me a coach today who could survive five seasons with that record. In his next four seasons at Stanford, he went 31-11-2 and won the Rose Bowl twice. So maybe there's a lesson to be learned there. More, I'm guessing it's more like a snapshot of an earlier time, but Ryan, there's one, my favorite, this is one of my favorite college football anecdotes, and it pertains to John Ralston. there was a beloved director of admissions at Stanford named Fred Hargadon, and beloved especially because he was the director of admissions when I got in. But everybody else loved him too. And he told a story a few years ago, shortly before he died, about John Ralston. And Hargadon said that the only coach in his career who ever tried to bribe him was Ralston. he said he would get a call at 11 in the morning, and he would say, "Fred, I'm coming over at noon to talk about recruiting candidates. What kind of sandwich would you like?" And Fred said, "I would say ham and cheese, John." He said, and he would come over. And Ralston was unfailingly positive. I mean, he was a Dale Carnegie guy from the get-go, no matter what happened. So he was in there trying to convince Hargadon to accept a particular running back who was never going to get into Stanford. And Hargadon finally said, "I'm really sorry, John. There's no way we can take this guy." And Ralston's response was, "Well, that's okay, Fred. He's going to be in our backfield one way or another next year." Now, the question is, I've heard that it pertained to two different players, and one was Russell White, who was the great running back at Cal in the 70s, and the other was that it pertained to a running back at USC from the early 70s. But either way, John Ralston won the Pac-8 twice in 70 and 71. Both times won upset victories in the Rose Bowl, Ohio State 1 year, Michigan the next, and he is a beloved figure at the farm. While we're in that conference, Ryan, Dick Tomey, who's such a fixture at Arizona for many years in the 80s and 90s, Dick Tomey, 29 seasons as a head coach at Hawaii, Arizona, and as with Ralston, San Jose State. One of the great defensive coaches of the last generation. He won 183 games at those schools, sent players like Rob Waltrip and Teddy Bruschi to the College Football Hall of Fame, and led Arizona to its only Pac-10 championship. The Wildcats shared the 1993 Pac-10 title, did not go to the Rose Bowl because UCLA went, and of course that season UCLA lost to Wisconsin in the Rose Bowl, while Arizona humiliated Miami and Dennis Erickson 29-0. That was the worst loss Dennis Erickson had in six seasons at the U.
Yeah, and I remember how stunning that game was, because it was obviously, you're talking about the U in the early 90s. And it was obviously they played a certain brand of football, and Arizona played, you know, that hard-nosed defensive brand of football. And I don't think anyone expected that to happen. And then it was one of those years where we all walked away thinking, man, what if that team had been in the Rose Bowl? But that's just the way, that was the way of the world then.
Well, the two games I remember from that period, in addition to that one, the year before, Arizona ended Washington's winning streak. Washington had won share of the national championship in 1991. And late in 1992, Washington came down to Tucson and Arizona spanked them 16-3. Again, a tremendous defensive performance. And then after that game, after that 29-0 defeat of Miami, Arizona began the 1994 season in the top 10. But opened the season at Penn State, and Penn State just road graded them. And of course, that was 1994, and Penn State, as it turned out, the 1994 team, one of the great teams of the decade, went undefeated that year. But Dick Tomey also had a 12-1 team in Arizona in 1998. They finished fourth in the country. Again, did not. Didn't even share the Pac-10 title. UCLA went unbeaten in the league that year, beat Arizona. The only other thing I want to say about Dick Tomey is one of my favorite people and maybe I should have said this from the get-go, but just one of my favorite people in college football. He was unfailingly interesting, but friendly, polite, intelligent. I always enjoyed interviewing him and talking to him. I last saw him in the San Jose State press box 2 or 3 years ago when San Jose State opened the season against South Florida, and I was in the Bay Area, and I went to the game, and Dick was there. He was just a wonderful guy. His wife, Nancy Kincaid, always at his side, and I bring Nancy up only because she wrote a novel about that was entitled Balls, and it remains the best book, fiction or not, ever written about what it's like to be married to a football coach. And wow. This happens to be a novel, but if you've never read Balls by Nancy Kincaid, by all means, please do.
Well, I always think about that. I always think about that 98 team. But what I really would like to have done was been around that team in the 90s just to be in the coaches' meetings. Because you had Dino Babers at one point, Pat Hill, who's one of the, you know, most delightfully wacko people in the history of college football. You know, I just can't imagine being in a room with some of those. It's a pretty amazing coaching tree. But then he's a guy who spent time with Dick Vermeil and Bo Schembechler and like Terry Donahue. And so but I've always thought about that 98 team because it was a weird – they lost that UCLA game, and it wasn't close. And
no, 52-28.
Right, but then ended the year, the one loss was to UCLA, and it actually ended the year ranked higher than UCLA. It was just one of those nights where it just something's just off. And if not for that game, they likely would have been playing for a national championship.
Yeah, you would love to have seen a team like that in the 14 playoff era, but. Dick Tomey, who's really the loss of Dick Tomey really saddened me, still saddens me. Another coach who won about as many games and coached as long as Dick Tomey, George Welch, 189 victories in 29 seasons at Navy, his alma mater, where he finished third in the 1955 Heisman race behind Hopalong Cassidy. But more famously as the coach at Virginia, where he took the Cavs to their only number one ranking in college football in 1990. And as well, they shared the 1989 title with Steve Spurrier and Duke, and shared the 1995 title with Bobby Bowden and Florida State, whose lone loss that season, I think it was their only loss, was to Virginia on a Thursday night.
Coach Walsh, I've spent as much time around him as probably any head coach growing up, like going to games in the ACC in the 80s and the 90s. And there was an intensity level to him.
Yeah.
He was militaristic. He earned that the old fashioned way with his Navy background. But I say this all the time. You and I talk about this when it comes to Oregon, when it comes to Kansas State, when it comes to some of these programs that an entire generation now just takes for granted they're pretty good at football. Virginia was so bad for so long.
Yes.
And he turned it around and did it in a really quick period of time. The 1990 Virginia team is one of the best teams that no one remembers. And yes. Sean Moore was a quarterback, and Herman Moore was the wide receiver.
Yeah.
And they had a killer defense, and the forgotten greatest game in the history of the ACC at Virginia that year, the Georgia Tech Virginia game. And Virginia was number one, as you said, for the first time ever, and Georgia Tech ended up winning a share of the national championship. But that's one of the greatest games I've ever seen.
41-38.
Yeah, and people forget about it, but Sean Moore hasn't forgotten about it. Anybody that was in that game, they remember it, but it was, but yes, the word that always pops into my mind when it comes to, Coach Welch is, intensity.
Yeah, well, you said militaristic. The word I wrote down was taciturn.
That's it.
He was tough to get a smile out of him. But just a terrific coach and exactly the right guy. You know, we talk about fit all the time in college football. He's exactly what Virginia needed at a time when it was just so downtrodden. But that Virginia Georgia Tech, the week of that game was Halloween week. One of the most memorable weeks, certainly in my career. I think I spent most of that week in Charlottesville, and just what a terrific college football event that game was. Mike McGee, the 1959 Outland Trophy winner at Duke, and more important, a head coach at his alma mater as well as East Carolina, and then a longtime AD at Cincinnati, USC, and South Carolina. Mike McGee died this year. And what I remember Mike McGee for, Ryan, you knew him better than I did. I knew him a little bit, but he was the guy who hired Mike Gottfried at Cincinnati, which yep. was a pretty good move. Larry Smith at USC, not so great, but not bad. And then most famously, after hiring Brad Scott at South Carolina and that didn't work out, he brought Lou Holtz and then Steve Spurrier to Columbia, which, of course, worked out really well.
Yeah, it worked out really well. And hired Dave Odom in basketball, hired Ray Tanner, who's now the athletic director, as the baseball coach and who won national championships in the College World Series. Mike McGee is a North Carolinian. He's born in Elizabeth City, way out on the coast. But, I don't mean to make this all about my family. But in this case, I want to tell you a story that Mike McGee loved to hear, which is the fact that my father's Jerry McGee, who was involved in collegiate athletics and was a university administrator and had known Mike McGee. I mean, they knew each other basically their whole lives. And they kind of were always in the same circles. And my father, who went to East Carolina, and, of course, Mike McGee used to be the head football coach at East Carolina. Every right. time we would go back to ECU when I was a kid in the 70s to go to events, inevitably everybody would introduce my father to everyone as Mike, not Jerry, which is his name. And it's like, hey, this is Mike McGee, used to be the head coach here, and Dad just wouldn't correct him. He'd just be like, yeah, great to meet you. And so to this day, that was 40-some-odd years ago, and to this day, when I call my dad on the phone and he answers the phone, I go, I'm looking for Mike McGee. And Mike McGee thought that was the funniest story, and he would repeat that story. But I love
that. That's awesome.
We're talking about lifetime collegiate people who made a lifetime in collegiate athletics. And this is an athlete, a coach, an administrator, and who had success on every single level. And it's just because he loved it. And what you always hear about Mike McGee is just had that smile on his face all the time. But then, when it was time to make a correction when maybe he made a bad hire, even with that smile on his face, he could make that correction.
He was, my memory of him was when he decided his course of action, he took it and he didn't care what anybody thought.
Yep.
And he did that in his hires at USC. He did it at every stop along the way. So Mike McGee, a longtime fixture in college athletics. David Williams, the first African-American athletic director in the SEC, and we should probably say athletic director in quotes, because even though he was he ran athletics at Vanderbilt for 16 years, he was never – he was actually upon – he was a vice chancellor at Vanderbilt, and when Gordon Gee, the former president at Vandy, put him in charge of athletics, he disbanded a separate athletic department and folded the operation of athletics into the campus office of student life. And this was Gee's attempt at athletic reform, and it caught on so much that nobody else ever did it. Including Gee when he subsequently went back to Ohio State in West Virginia. But it worked it worked and still works at Vanderbilt. And David Williams was a beloved figure, not only on the Nashville campus, but throughout the SEC. Vanderbilt won four national championships in his tenure there, two in women's bowling, one in women's tennis, and one in baseball. And he was just a solid guy, a fount of common sense, and just the right guy to be at Vanderbilt.
And at the College World Series this year, Vanderbilt won that series in 2014, played for the championship in 15, but then when they won the College World Series title this past summer, I was there, and Tim Corbin, who is a beloved figure in all of collegiate athletics, but obviously in baseball, but not an overly emotional person. Tim Corbin broke down after Vanderbilt won that College World Series. And when he was asked why, he said, because he said, I hope that David Williams and his family understand that this is a gift to them. And that's all I really need to know about David Williams. And the son of a Tuskegee Airman. I mean, just an incredible life. And you know, as it is with everyone on this podcast, and you started the podcast by saying this, it's odd to say that we enjoy doing this, but if you can throw a spotlight on the life of David Williams and what he meant to so many and what he continues to mean to so many, then that's an important task.
Well, sadly, he retired 8 days before he died. He died suddenly, and that was just so heartbreaking that happened. I'll close it with an anecdote that David Williams told me he did with athletes at Vanderbilt, that he would bring them into his office, and in order to stress what their first priority would be, he had a stack of books on the floor of his office next to a football, and he would ask them to stand on the stack of books, and they would stand on the stack of books, and they would step down. He would say, now stand on the football. And his point to them was, what is the foundation of your life going to be when you leave here? And it was a lesson that was unfailingly effective for his student athletes. And it was one that he used over and over with them. So that's it for our 2019 show. And I want to thank our producer, Taylor Schwenk, for Ryan McGee. This is Ivan Maisel, and we will be back with you next year.